Anyway, good morning, Eddie. Hello.
Good morning, Miff, and good morning, everybody else. Good to see you all. Well, let's begin. So just get comfortable in your seat. Make sure your back is straight. And while you breathe normally and naturally, just become aware of the movements that take place in your body, as you breathe. And with each exhalation, just try to relax a little more. So with the exhalation, we are releasing and relaxing into our natural state. And from within that natural state, all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas appear above us, and all sentient beings surround us. And we recognize that every sentient being has, at one stage or another, been a parent to us, or a brother or a sister. They've been related to us. And in that relationship, they are very kind to us. And now that we have the body and mind of a human being, and that we've met the Dharma and authentic Dharma teachers, we have the opportunity to repay their kindness. And our method that will bring about that repayment is to train in the perfections until we attain enlightenment. I think that this is what we're trying to do: attain enlightenment for the benefit of others, thereby bringing about our welfare and the welfare of every other living being. To accomplish the two welfares, we'll take refuge in the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, all the enlightened beings who are in the space surrounding us. So I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now, to stabilize this wish and to increase it, we can recite the four immeasurable thoughts together. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. To accomplish enlightenment that brings about the two welfares, we need to abandon forms of our thinking and behavior and adopt other forms. And these are all summed up within the seven limb prayer. So reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the meritable holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. We're going to make an offering of a mandala, a universal system. to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas who are in front of us. And the essence of this practice is to just let go of clinging to thoughts that we think are true and real, let go of the grasp at the body and mind, let go of the merits that appear to be truly established. So in the absence of the clinging, a wonderful pure land will appear, and we offer this to the Buddhas. So this ground, anointed with perfume and strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamayatayami. So the offering is accepted by the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, and they smile at us. Then the vast merit field begins to dissolve into light, melting into the central figure of Guru Shakyamuni Buddha. His size begins to diminish, and he moves through space until he abides above the crown of your head. Facing the same way you are, he begins to descend through space, entering the crown of your head. Comes to rest at the level of your heart. And then the light rays begin to fill your body and mind. The light rays move out through the pores of your skin. They penetrate the 10 directions of space. And wherever there are living beings within that space, they become transformed and fully awakened. From the heart of each of the enlightened beings, light rays once again expand to the 10 directions of space. And there is a vast absence between self and other, between inner and outer. These conventionalities have fallen away. Now the light begins to withdraw from the 10 directions and enters your heart. And as you breathe normally and naturally, you feel yourself embodied. With a recognition of the deepest nature of your own mind, which has the potential to be transformed completely into a fully awakened being. And, you know, we wish to awaken that nature, to become fully awakened for the benefit of others. And so this is our purpose for listening to these teachings and engaging in them. So now breathe in deeply through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and allow your eyes to flutter open, and notice that you're sitting in your seat and you're in front of the screen. And I'll begin the class now. Okay, so we're doing this perfection of generosity, and where are we? What we've covered is this perfection of generosity, also called the perfection of charity. And then we've learned what giving is and how to give. And we learned that over a period of 9 classes. Now, today we're going to respond to 40 odd questions that have been asked so that we can discover what we do know and what we don't know about this topic. Now, as you know, I did not send out the questions for you guys to examine or anything. It was just a heap of them. So the first 40 we're going to just do today. And but for I have put up the last 16 of them. So perhaps over the break, just so that you don't lose your understanding of this material, you can have a look at the last 16 questions and see how you go about answering them. And then when we come back, we'll have a look at those 16. And then when we finish that, we'll begin the new perfection on morality or ethics. So the Buddha said that every sentient being wants happiness, and there is no human happiness without wealth. So understanding that wealth comes from generosity, the Buddha taught generosity first. Now, the material I've relied upon are all of these books, of course, but the major ones being the great treatise down the bottom, the Lam Rim Chenmo, the one above it, Steps on the Path to Enlightenment, and also Kensa Rinpoche Geshe Tashi Tsering's commentary on the Lam Rim Chenmo. So the first question that's asked in the review material is, what is generosity? So I thought I'd put it up there like this, and that way you can see it very easily. And when you get hold of this material, you can sort of quickly go to it. So the nature of generosity is the intention accompanying bodhisattvas' disinterested non-attachment to all their possessions and their body. And motivated by this, the physical and verbal actions of giving the things to be given. So you can see here really this, that we're talking about the, if you ask, what is generosity? So this is just not, as you can see, we're talking about the perfection of generosity. So we have generosity, which has a type of intention accompanying the bodhisattva. So the bodhisattva wishes to attain enlightenment for the benefit of others. And when he gives, when he performs the act of charity, the act of generosity, going along with that should be this intention to bring about the enlightenment of all sentient beings. So sometimes, like if you meet somebody who would be sort of query the word perfection in relationship to the perfection of generosity. It might seem that your perfection, your generosity is so perfect that every living being is not in a state of poverty any longer. But that, of course, is not what it means. So it does not mean abolishing all the poverty in the world. That's what it does not mean. So I think we should sort of remember that. And of course, always try to remember it's really an intention. Now, the main aspect of generosity, which is the second question, which asks, what is the main aspect in the practice of generosity? This is from the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. It says, the perfection of generosity is said to be the thought of giving to all beings your possessions and your merits. Thus, the perfection of generosity is dependent on the mind. And this is the main aspect of this perfection of generosity. Then we have this next question coming up, which asks a lot, what is mental, verbal, and physical generosity? And simply put, it's this. So physical generosity is the giving of these two things, protection and also called, and another thing called fearlessness. Verbal generosity is the giving of the Dharma. And mental generosity really refers to non-attachment. And this term that came up a lot with the Geshe-la used, called the intention to relinquish. So relinquishing is really sort of like to let go, isn't it? Letting go. Letting go of the sort of things that we sort of hold on to. So generosity is really the generous attitude, the intention to give. And he said, perhaps we shouldn't even say, we could become very literal and just say, it's the intention to relinquish, to let go. And mental generosity is basically the giving of your roots of virtue to others, and also the effects of giving to them. Now, so as I'm going through, like I know, so today I think, Robin, your first time to do over this material. So I guess in a way it's very good that you're here, because you get this complete review. But also, if any of you have questions at the time, please let Miffy know, and Miffy can sort of feed it through to me and we can answer those. So the next question.
Eddie, just maybe every now and again, just kind of stop and see if there's any comments on the things that you know are quite topical, for instance.
Well, I've blocked off that whole thing of, what people I can't see that, so you'll have to do that. So the next question is, upon what does the measure of having perfected generosity depend upon? So we know that generosity is dependent, because anything that exists is dependent. So how do we measure it? So here it says, you perfect generosity after you destroy your stingy clinging to all that you own, meaning your body, resources, and roots of virtue. And you completely condition your mind to giving them away to living beings from the depths of your heart. And not only that, but also to giving to others the effects of this giving as well. So Kinsa Rinpoche said again, the measure of having perfected generosity depends upon whether or not you have developed the intention to relinquish to its utmost extent. So you can see here, isn't it, that we will not have perfected until we have to first destroy our stinginess, our clinging to the things that we own, which include the body, the resources, and our roots of virtue, and also the effects of having given them. Now, the next question that's asked is, when we practice giving and taking, in the practice of Tonglen, can we expect there to be some sort of positive effect? So here we might have some questioning. Question is basically, will meditating on giving and taking help? So Geshe-la, of course, responds, and we should probably all respond, going, yes, of course it helps. But the question is, how does it help? So it does not necessarily help in the sense that the person you're doing the giving and taking for becomes free of their problems. Although it could happen if you have a very strong karmic effect with that person. Now, for us, the person whoever is practicing the giving and taking, there are effects that take place there. For one, there's a diminishment of the self-cherishing. There is the development of greater courage in the face of suffering. There are the benefits of developing love and But one of the other benefits, or one of the great positive effects of the practice of giving and taking in relationship to the practice of generosity, is that through this imaginative practice, we are drawn closer and closer to actually doing the things that we are imagining within the practice. So when others are actually experiencing suffering, we might find ourselves stepping forward quite quickly to help them in whatever way we could do. We would recognize their suffering and wish to put an end to it and put ourselves in the service of the other. The other thing is that we know that they want to be happy as well, so that we will find ourselves being able to perhaps give the resources that might be required for that person. So through the imaginative practices of Tonglen, we are drawn closer to the actual practices of serving sentient beings, giving them the resources necessary to diminish their suffering and bring about greater happiness. So, just as by doing the Tonglen meditation practice, what happens when you encounter people, this practice sort of matches up with your actual desire to help them. Is this clear for everyone? Have I explained it sort of in a way that you get it?
So everybody, you still do have the power to unmute. So if you want to, please do. And Eddie, if you want to actually see anybody waving at you, you just change the view up at the top right. So you can actually see who's there.
Top right. Not gonna, I don't know what you're saying there, so I'm not going to do that. So I'll take it as all clear. It's okay. Nothing's confusing.
Well, there's no comments yet.
Okay. So
Yep.
we'll go on. Now the next question is what's incompatible with the practice of generosity? So what gets in the way of being generous? So here are the major obstacles that prevent us having an attitude of charity. So you can see there are miserliness, stinginess, attachment, and then not seeing the faults of being miserliness, stinginess, and attachment. So really what we're saying here, the real psychological obstacle to generosity is wanting to hold on to things as ours. Now there are antidotes we can use to put an end to the obstacles. So the first thing is to look at the faults of holding on to things. So on the other side, you've got the not seeing the faults. So we'll have a look at what the faults are. What happens when you just hold on to your parts of your body, withholding kind speech and verbal generosity, and also the faults of holding on to different ideas and so forth. So we've got to look at the faults first, and that will encourage us to not engage with them and move over to sort of practice charity. And then we can do that by also seeing the benefits of giving. So faults of holding on, faults of attachment, overestimating the things that we own and our resources, our body, and so forth. And then we can also look at impermanence, love, compassion, and faith. So these are all antidotes that can be used to overcome those four obstacles there. I guess Usopa says that it takes a repeated analysis of both the obstacles and the antidotes before we can develop a spontaneous desire to give. So remember, because this is the Mahayana, destroying the miserliness from the root is still not enough to complete the perfection of generosity. We need to have something more positive, and this is where we have love and compassion coming into it. In particular, a great compassion and great affection. So we have to sort of want others to have the freedom of true liberation and the happiness that comes with enlightenment. So these obstacles, especially attachment, stinginess, not seeing the faults and so forth, like we see, can be developed towards your body, the speech, or the mind. So the next question asks, how are we advised to stop attachment to the body, and in particular, and also attachment to just this life? So once again, we could use these antidotes. See, these antidotes would help us. Here's a quote. He said, "These childish people are attached to this rotting body and to this rushing life force, both of which lack independence and are like a dream or a magician's illusion." So in essence, what this verse is saying to us is that we have to stop attachment to the body and the idea of a single life. We can do this by viewing the body as an unclean entity, and life itself to be like a Russian mountain cascade. That also both our mind and life are empty of an independent self because they're under the control of karma. And both to be as false as a dream or a magician's illusion, which is really pointing us to how the body itself and life itself lack inherent existence, although they appear to have it. And that's why we sort of clasp and cling to them.
Eddie, there is a question here what's the dividing line between clinging onto your body and looking after your body as, you know, part of the perfect human rebirth?
Well, you can do both.
But how do you draw the, how do you make the distinction or draw the line?
To know of both. So the idea of looking like at, you know, the faults of the body is to stop you clinging to it with attachment. The thing is, but while it's all true that this is, you know, this rotting body and you can all look and see all that, that's just the nature of the body. Nevertheless, with that body, you can achieve enlightenment and benefit all sentient beings.
So, in fact, one of them would actually support the other. So,
yeah, they do.
It's kind of not
work against one another.
Seeing the faults and not clinging to your body means you can actually appreciate its kind of ultimate worth.
Yeah, it's greater it's greater value.
Yeah.
Lastly, it says, Geshe Sopa says, if we do not stop attachment, then we will become dominated by it. And when we're dominated by it, we will build up great wrongdoings and therefore, you know, proceed to miserable realms. So once again, there's a supporting this thing. So asking really much about this question just asked, you know, what's the main point being made? especially in this quote also. This has come from many of trainings by Shantideva, and it said, you know, thus my body and mind change every moment. So why not trade it for something priceless? For this impermanent body, dripping filth, you obtain permanent pure enlightenment. So this is just, you know, this is sort of referring to the past question as well, isn't it? He says, the body is changing every moment. Every kind of unclean thing is contained in it, and it is the source of polluting filth. The body is impure, but if we use it properly, we can turn it into something supremely valuable. We could practice generosity and eliminate attachment. But through the Mahayana practice of mental purification, we can attain the permanent, stainless body of Buddhahood. So this ordinary body has the capacity to establish a priceless, pure thing. It's like trading something bad for something invaluable. So why not do it? And this is how yogis talk to themselves. You know, it's like the same with us, isn't it? So if we have some accident happens and the body's hurt, or we get sick, or all sorts of things can happen to the body that we have. And I know myself that sometimes when that happens, you get, a little bit agitated, a little bit angry, and upset. But, you got to go, yep, that's the nature of a body. That's what happens to a samsaric body. And that's always going to be the case unless you exchange, unless you what do you call it, change up and get a body of a Buddha, because that's not going to have a body of the Buddha. And that's, that's, if we wish to become Buddhas, we will have the body of a Buddha. So we've got to use the thing that we've actually got, because we can't do it without this body. I mean, the wonderful thing about this body is that we can engage actually in the practice of Tantra and transform it. Without this body, it couldn't be done.
Eddie, so Jeanette's saying giving up attachment to the body gets easier the older you are.
That's dead right. That's right, Jeanette. If you use your mind, isn't it? You have these insights, isn't it? It's what was great when we were 20, 14 to 20 odd. It's not so great now. So we should trade up. Now, when we practice generosity, of course, one of the things that we do is generate merit. And this merit also has to be let go of, has to be offered. We need to practice generosity with it. So the next question asks, how does our dedication increase the merit we gain from our generosity? So in the Lam Rim Chenmo, it says this: if you dedicate from the depths of your heart all your roots of virtue, however great or small they may be, for the sake of accomplishing both temporarily and ultimately extensive benefit and happiness for all living beings, and then you give something, then you obtain the merit related to each living being. So the Buddha said this, and there's a logic to it. The expanse of living beings is immeasurable. The merit of the wish to help them is the same. So Geshe Sopa says this, just to help us understand. There is one virtue that you accumulate in giving to one sentient being. But if you give to 100, then you accumulate the virtue of giving to 100. But if you give to immeasurable sentient beings, then the roots of virtue become immeasurable. So this is the logic. So it's logical that we gain as much merit as there are recipients to whom we give. sentient beings are numberless. There are so many that they cannot be counted. Thus, we dedicate our merit to all of them, we obtain a limitless merit. So I was just thinking, as I'm saying this, you know, like, I think, like, it is logical, isn't it? Because if you think, like just in this life, if there are sort of five people in front of you, and you have enough to give to five people, but you give it all to one person, right? So it's one really happy person, probably likes us for giving them so much, but then you've got four unhappy people. If you got the wealth and gave it to two, then there'd be two very happy people and three probably sad. And you give three, four, five. If you give enough to five, then you have five happy people. So it's just like that.
So, Eddie, is there any way, say, for instance, when we're, you know, giving Christmas presents, that when we are just giving to actual individuals, is there any way we can do like a stealth dedication to increase it?
Oh, of course. Yeah, so, yeah, of course there is. So this is why, yeah, we call, yeah, if you look at what's the essential nature of generosity, what's the most important factor of it? So someone has to respond now.
The intention?
Yeah, it's the mental aspect, isn't it? It's the mental aspect. So it doesn't matter how small the offering is or how large it is, or whether there is one person in front of us or a million people in front of us. It's the mental attitude that we need to take up when we give the gifts, when we give the things. So, you know, when we give it, we think, well, you know, so we're giving this, may I attain the enlightenment and bring all beings to enlightenment. That's the first thing you've got to do. Otherwise, it's definitely not a Mahayana practice, and it's not the perfection of generosity.
Yeah, it's so easy to just forget that the main thing is what the attitude in the mind, because we just get tangled up with the things, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. The things and the people, that becomes for us the most important things. So, yeah, there, as we saw before, there conditions that can increase our stinginess. There are conditions that can hinder our inclinations to be generous. And these conditions we need to avoid. And so what are they? It's companions and belongings. So this is, once again, we have to remember it's the attitude that we take towards our companions and our belongings we need to really check up on. It's not the companions and the belongings themselves. If you find yourself having a lot of attachment to your companions or to your belongings, you'll know that's where the problem is. No, my own mind is the problem here. So he says here, to avoid stinginess and the weakening of our inclination to be generous, we need to avoid holding on to companions and belongings that prevent our ability to give things away, that intensify stinginess, that stop the development of previously absent inclinations to give, or that weaken the intensity to give. So it says, do not take on these kinds of companions or accept these kinds of material gifts, the offers have been made to of them. So if you find yourself becoming more stingy, having more attachment towards certain companions, certain belongings, you have to avoid those belongings and companions. This is what it's suggesting here. It's not them that's actually the problem, though, is it? It's how you're relating to them. But as you are unable to stop your clinging and your stinginess, then you have to separate yourself from those objects. So this passage is looking at some of the things that prevent the increase of a generous attitude, your intention to give. So when it says, do not take on these kinds of companions or belongings, it means do not think of them as yours. So that's quite simple to work with, isn't it? Well, it's a bit simpler. They're not mine. But that's what we often do, isn't it? That's how our attachment and our stinginess grows. These things are mine. So do not, in a sense, identify with them and embrace them. If a material gift of this type kind is given to you, where you find your attachment increases, then don't accept it if it's for your own sake. The point here is to try to have few desires. So Geshe-la says, do not fall prey to having great desires. And so once again, and I like to just fill this up again with what Geshe Sopa says, it's not the things themselves that are the problem. The things themselves are neither good or bad. Whether or not they are problematic depends upon the person in question. It says that even the seven precious royal things are not suitable for a bodhisattva if he or she is very attached to them. For this reason, bodhisattvas, and ourselves as well, should not hold on to property like this. And even if someone offers it to us, we should not accept it. This is, if you remember here, it's really talking about your own attitudes of clinging and stinginess. If you find that it's coming up, you have to be very careful. So there's some questions that arise out of this and the sort of offences that bodhisattvas can commit. So we've got two questions coming up for the next slide, which are, how do you understand the secondary offence of the bodhisattva vows, which instructs us not to refuse to accept something offered out of stinginess? And then, does this contradict Lama Tsongkhapa's advice not to accept these kinds of material things, even if others offer them? So these secondary offences, there are like 46 of them, and they're all related to the 18 root bodhisattva vows. And there's one of them that says, we should not accept something out of stinginess. That means if you're given something and you refuse to take it because you want to prevent this person from gaining the merit of giving, this would be called not accepting out of stinginess. Alternatively, you might refuse to accept something because you're not thinking about the other's actions or what can be done with the gift. This would be like the secondary offense. In relation to the second question was asked, does this contradict Lama Tsongkhapa's advice not to accept these kinds of material gifts, even if others offer them? So the answer is no. So in brief, what's happening here is somebody is offering us something, and we're saying no to it. Why? To prevent that person gaining the merit of giving something to us. So I think it's a there's some material about this that comes up again later on as well. So when we're saying this, so there's, we've got two things here. One is the person's offering us something and we are saying no, and it affects the other person badly, right? Because we're saying, if you say no to them, you prevent them generating merit. And that's your intention, right?
So they don't. Eddie, that's quite a spiteful thing to do. So
it is, isn't it?
Jeanette's kind of asking who would do that. So I'm just thinking, well, maybe in a divorce proceeding or something. But what's an example of like somebody actually having that as a reason to, you know, to stop you creating merit? I mean,
One of the major things is anger. Like you say, anger and spite. So, you know, like I said, with ordinary people who don't know and have not taken the vow and so forth and don't know about this vehicle, you know, you can be offered, like you say, you're so angry at somebody that they have offered you something that would actually be of benefit to you, but you go, no.
Oh, like when when you have an argument and someone gives you money and you go, you throw the money back in their face and you go,
right.
I'm not taking your money.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's often like, you know, there's another way too, isn't it? Sometimes, you know, you have an argument and one person, you know, you can see that you can't, you can see that your partner's not going to back down. So you back down and apologize, and then they don't take the apology. It's a similar type of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, so we can see
generosity.
That out of spite. Yep.
Yeah, and it's just because the person who doesn't want to accept the apology is still hurting and they want to hurt the other person back. It's sort of anger and spite. But like I say, but if the person offers you a gift and you know yourself that you will have attachment to that gift, then you're better off to say no.
I'm going to have a really hard time at Christmas. I mean, this is really difficult.
Yeah, you've got to keep a close eye on your mind.
I mean, in a way, it's much easier practicing generosity and giving things to others than actually receiving things without attachment. That's like,
oh yeah, for sure,
a whole other thing.
That's right. So here's, you know, like I said, the whole thing is to it's so to get away from, you've got to sort of get rid of your own stinginess, and that's hard. You know, we have a mind that naturally goes out and looks at objects and sees them inherently and views the object to have all these good qualities itself. And then so then we want that object, thinking this will make us happy. You know, so that's the sort of thing we've got to go, actually, it doesn't. All that's really doing is increasing my attachment. You know, anything external to the mind is not the major source, is not the true cause of happiness. So it's sort of trying to, you know, remember our past material on karmic cause and effect, and actually wanting, clinging to these objects is actually producing more suffering for ourselves. So the next slide, interesting, it's called the elephant analogy, right? So it says, you know, our behavior is compared to an elephant's bathing. Like, why is that? So what's the sound analogy is really pointing out to us is that sometimes we get it right and then we get it wrong. And we get it right and then we get it wrong. It's like this backwards and forwards things. You know? So the elephant goes into the water and cleans itself off of all the dust and the mites that get on and all that sort of thing. Like, it's nice and freshened up. But then it gets out of it and then it rolls around the dirt again. And then it gets back in the water again. So this is basically, this analogy is describing our own back and forth behavior. So we're pulled one way and promised to practice the perfection of generosity and giving things to other sentient beings. Then we're pulled the other way because we get really attached to the possessions. So it's Generosity sometimes in attachment, other times. You know, it was back and forth, back and forth. And it's describing, just like this elephant, it was out there on the land, it was all dirty, it wanted to get nice and sort of cleaned up, but it wanted to become, you know, freshened, just cooled down. So it gets cooled down, then he comes out and he dirties himself again. So it's describing the backwards and forwards way our mind works, where we give things away. Sometimes remember to put it with the mind of bodhicitta, this aspiration for enlightenment. Other times we forget. So once again, it's back and forwards, back and forwards. Sometimes we give, you know, practicing dharma, other times we don't.
Eddie, also I'm thinking that the more involved we are with the present, so if it's someone really close to us or if it's someone who's really suffering, the easier it is to forget this.
Oh, yeah. Yep, that's right.
Because we get all, involved in the actual immediate suffering situation, we forget this big picture.
Yep.
Which is kind of ironic because they're the ones that are the most powerful actions, aren't they? And yet we kind of miss the ticket of how to make them powerful.
Yep. So we so now we come to, yeah. So these are basically the three things to give away. So we have to begin by mentally giving them away. So the three things we have to give away mentally are the body, the resources, and our roots of virtue. And these are the three objects, what we call the three objects to focus upon. And we can mentally give them away to all beings. So there's a little verse that says, I will give away without a sense of loss my body and my resources, as well as my virtue from the past, present, and future, for the welfare of all living beings. So I'm just going to stop here. We'll have our, it's just about 11 o'clock, maybe say 7 minutes or so. So five, come back at 11:05, everyone.
Shall we just check if anyone has any questions at the moment? Or
sure. Anyone have questions?
Just stop the screen share for a sec, hon.
Miffy, I had a question.
Yes, go for it.
I just didn't catch when Eddie was talking about the question 14, which says, "Does this contradict Lama Tsongkhapa's advice not to accept these kinds of material gifts?" I sort of missed what he said about that.
Okay. I think what would probably be best to make it easier for this rather than me just repeating myself again. So you have Kensa Rinpoche's Lama and Chenmo commentary, don't you, Linda? Linda?
Yeah, somewhere. Yep.
Oh, okay. I was going to say I could give you the module, you know, the teaching and so forth.
Okay. That's all right. Give me that and I'll see if I can find it.
Okay. So, it's of course, it's in this, you know, this second module, and it's on teaching 29 mm-hmm. on page 12. And it's seen in paragraphs 3 and 4.
Okay. Thanks, Eddie.
Yeah. Otherwise, probably if you also have Geshe Sofa's book, have a look there also. But sometimes, like I said, it's not so clear. Just to fill in a bit more about your question, Linda. So in the great treatise, the Lama Chenmo, yeah, the book by Lama Tsongkhapa, so there's some material there on page 119 and 120, but also in Geshe Sofa's book on page, about midway down on page 269 of volume 3. And it goes over the page for a few, say about 3 or 4 pages, just talking about these differences in terms of the vow. So I hope that
thanks.
You'll find
thanks,
that
Eddie.
Useful.
Thank you.
Okay, now let's have this other question here is also related to these, the conditions. for us to be called bodhisattvas. So the question is, what are the conditions cited for us to be called a bodhisattva? So we've looked at some of these, and the idea is really we have to stop the craving that conceives everything to be our own personal property, and then repeatedly condition ourselves to the attitude of giving it all away to others. If we can do this, then we can be called a bodhisattva. So I've sort of summed it up by saying, like, all these things are yours. I have no pride that they are mine. Someone who has this amazing thought repeatedly and emulates the qualities of the perfect Buddha is called a bodhisattva. So said the inconceivable Buddha, the supreme being. So this is a verse taken from the Lamrim Chenmo. So this is a very skillful means, skillful way, I think, that would help us. So here I've put like two pictures. One is this idea of you've got to stop the craving. And I know myself, I have a particular craving for pastries that have cream in them. So I thought this one's very suitable for me. You can just look at it and then actually give things away. So a helpful way to think about this is that all these things are yours. I'm just holding them in trust, so to speak. And I don't have any pride that they actually belong to me. They're not mine. Now here we have another thing about these infractions in terms of the vows. So actually, when I look back at this now, I should have perhaps put these two together with the other one would have helped. Okay, so let's have a look at them. So here are, you know, when we have these infractions, they can be divided into major and minor.
So this is a picture of Eddie as a boy.
And a man too, unfortunately. Not much difference. So this might also help Linda with this idea. So first is a major infraction if you have craving, not just towards the gift, but for your own. So like for here, you know, I'm going to eat this cake. It's going to be great for me. I will like it. Right? So it's all about me eating the cake and me feeling great about that. Then I forget, oh my gosh, you're like, I do need to eat food and so forth to nourish the body so that I can keep working to attain enlightenment. So I've got these two things there. I just have craving for personal welfare, and I just forget the thought that food is nourishment or medicine for the body so that I can live a long life and keep practicing, learning to practice the perfections and become enlightened for anyone else. So if that's the case, we have a major infraction on the bodhisattva vows. The infraction becomes minor if we are without craving, but we forget our focus, which is enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. So in other words, we could, you know, like sit down and just have dinner, and we just forget that, you know, we're not craving, we're not, hunger is not driving us on to go just me, me, me. But the meal's been put out. We don't have any obvious craving. But when we eat, we forget, you know, I should be eating to nourish the body, to help me live a long life and become enlightened to bring about enlightenment for the self, for the sake of others.
So question there, Eddie. Mm-hmm. Isn't it back into one of the refuge vows or commitments that you offer everything that you eat or drink up to the sort of Buddhas and gurus, you know, the omahom, you know, all the things, you know, I offer up these to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas first? Like, doesn't that go back to refuge, and isn't that a good way ourselves?
Well, the refuge got the two things, isn't it? The Mahayana refuge is you take refuge in the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and you know, this is you know, to practice the perfections to become enlightened.
Mm.
Yeah. Yep, so this, you know, so you've got sort of everything in there.
Yeah. But doesn't it help if we are remembering that, it helps us not to have these infractions because we offer first up to them and it's not about us when you eat and drink.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah. Also, Eddie, I'm just thinking like coming up Christmas dinners and things that, you know, if you go to a Christmas dinner and someone served all of this beautiful food, then there's no point, you know, feeling bad about enjoying the food. We might be able to not crave, but it's easy to forget about the focus.
Yeah, that's
isn't
right.
It, that one.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, we see here that these perfections are nearly all mental.
Mm. So it's, I mean, a part of it would be to remember to offer all of the enjoyment, isn't
it? Yep, that's right. Yeah, so you've got this is right. And, you know, also the fact that, you know, we're trying to become enlightened, even the merit that we're generating.
Yeah. Yep. Chris Lumley also has a question that it's difficult to achieve the bodhisattva condition, particularly as certain possessions are so difficult to obtain and take such long and hard work, such as, you know, paying off a house.
Yeah.
In preparation for retirement and things like that, really big things.
Yeah. So, yes, it can be, but, you know, the thing to remember there, which to make it easier, is that you're going to leave it anyway when you die. So, it won't be yours because you won't be there.
So is that a skillful way that, like, you know, if we have a will or if we have a plan like that, we're already in our mind giving it away. It's already
gone. Yep.
In trust with us.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, it's like, you know, say, Chris, you know, well, you know, I've bought this house not for me but for my family or, you know, and all sentient beings. I offer it to my family. It's not mine. May all beings find shelter. The shelter of the Dharma, the shelter of the mind of enlightenment and so forth.
So in your mind, if you think of your house as a shelter for everybody.
Yeah. Yep, yeah, but, you know, we know, isn't it, there's lots of people who have pride in their homes. What, you know, pride in just whatever they possess. It could be a home, could be money, could be their reputation, all these sort of things.
Yeah, because the home signifies the me, doesn't it? The me
yeah.
And mine.
That's right. And then so now this last one goes out of attachment here. So then we use the resources of for a particular person. And we forget that it's not, you know, not just for one particular person, it should be for all sentient beings. So we're using a resource of some sort, but we're just focused on one person. Like, you know, you see so many times when we have the pujas, I hear it so often that everyone just talks about my family, my daughter, my this, my that. It never goes beyond that. So this just shows us how much attachment we have that we forget the focus. You know, it's when we all sentient beings that we, you know, and we become enlightened for. It's for all sentient beings. So, of course, we can, you know, mention our family, but it'd be nice also if we went a little bit beyond that, especially if you think that, you know, all beings have been your family, members of your family, countless times. But like I said, we often just remember the family of this lifetime. Okay, let's move on. There's the question of offering a mandala. So the question is, we offer all our possessions and wealth in mandala offerings. Is it then a problem to use them for our own welfare, forgetting the benefit of others? Now, if we forget the benefit of others, yes, it's problematic. Now, that's the fault. But it's not a fault if we make use of them for the sake of others. So here, Kinsa Rinpoche said, remember, we have already mentally given these things to other beings. But now we're partaking of them and so forth, using these goods so that we can benefit them, so that we can accomplish their welfare. So, you know, like, I mean, I think we need to, what will make it a bit easier for us is to just remember a couple of things. I like this idea of us being stewards. These are not mine. Like the Aboriginal cultures do, you know, this country is not mine. Yep, I don't own the country.
We're custodians.
We're just looking after it, and we're going to return it. I'm just using it, but it's not mine.
This example, Eddie, of the mandala reminds me of a story that Venerable Robina told us about her amazing mandala set that she, you know, had collected all the bits and pieces over the years, precious things given to her by lamas and all sorts of, and, you know, so Venerable Robina, quite small physically, with this huge mandala set that she had great pleasure in offering, you know, all the time. And she said then 1 year she left it on the subway in New York, and her first thought was, oh, my mandala is gone. And then she realized, oh, of course, not mine. She'd been giving it away for all those years, and yet.
Yeah, it's a, you know, I mean, it's great, isn't it? It's great that, you know, you can just catch your own hypocrisy, your own mind. The words are coming out of your mouth, but the mind is actually not. They haven't sort of met up yet. Our own minds and words have not met up yet. But that's just the way it is, isn't it? You know, I mean, that's, you know, I think that's a great thing that Robina should say something like that. And then we could find ourselves doing exactly the same thing. Yeah. So let's go on to the next one. So there's a question here that says, you know, the first section under the divisions of generosity is how everyone should practice generosity. And the practice is associated with these six supremacies. They ask us to list them, and these are the six supremacies, and then give a brief explanation of each of them. So the basis is the mental attitude, the spirit of enlightenment. The things as anything that you're going to give. The supreme aim is for the benefit of all sentient beings. The supreme skill and means is when your generosity is imbued with your understanding, or even the wisdom itself, that knows that the offering, myself, the person I'm giving it to, the goal I'm seeking, they all lack inherent existence. They're all empty of inherent existence. The dedication, supreme dedication, is that you're dedicating the virtue from generosity to complete enlightenment. And the supreme purity is when you sort of stop the afflictive and cognitive obscurations. But you can find more about this material in depth, of course, within the Lam Chinmo and the other study materials we've looked at. Now, all the perfections can be found in one another. So here's just a list of the six perfections, and you can find the generosity of generosity, the ethical discipline of generosity, patience of generosity, generosity of patience, and so forth. And so, of course, this also you can find in the commentaries of Geshe Sopa and the briefly in the Lam Rim Chimo itself. Now, when you look at the practice of generosity, there are different divisions within it. Relative to persons, of course. So the question is, who are the persons? And the answer is lay bodhisattvas and monastic bodhisattvas. Meaning, you know, like people like you and I who are not ordained and are trying to practice the perfection of generosity, and those people who are ordained and practicing the perfection of generosity. So the next question is, what's the difference? And what are each of them encouraged to offer? And why is that? So the most obvious difference, of course, is straight away, we've got lay persons who have taken bodhisattva vows, but not the vows of ordination. Then we have monastic bodhisattvas, of course, who've taken the vows of ordination and are practicing the perfection of generosity. What is each of them encouraged to give? So lay bodhisattvas are encouraged to make offerings of the material types, whereas monastic bodhisattvas are really encouraged to give the teachings of the Dharma. Why is that? Well, one thing is lay people often have very, very busy lives and don't have a great deal of many opportunities and so forth to engage in the study of the Dharma. Whereas the monastics, of course, have much more opportunities to actually study Dharma and then to teach it. Nevertheless, you know, like we know that basically, lay persons like ourselves, for instance, can have some depth of the knowledge of the perfections and can teach it to others that don't have our knowledge. And as well as that, we can give money, food, and so forth. And it's the same for the monastic bodhisattvas. We know people who are ordained, who have taken up the perfections and still work. However, it's said that, you know, for those who are ordained and working, it's very, it can be very difficult because you can, what's said is they can harm their ethical discipline as they strain searching for wealth to give away. Divisions of actual generosity are giving of teachings, giving of Dharma, giving fearlessness, and giving of material gifts. So just a little bit about each. The gift of the teaching. So this is, of course, teaching the sublime teaching, the Dharma, the true paths, without making mistakes. Also teaching the arts and the like, meaning the worldly occupations, and involving others in upholding the precepts. Giving fearlessness is the gift of protection, of refuge, protecting living beings from different types of fear. And giving material gifts, that's pretty much straightforward, isn't it? So it's again, what is the gift of fearlessness, the gift of protection, the gift of refuge? Now, when it comes to giving, there are many giving material things. There are sort of 10 types of recipient listed. And I had those up on a different slide. But since this list seems to embrace the entire variety of sentient beings, the question is, why does he think Lama Tsongkhapa lists the various types so fully? So this was quite interesting because Geshe's response to it was that Lama Tsongkhapa presents things in a very unique way, and he's doing this basically so that we are benefited by it, that our minds are helped. So this is the major reason for like having, when you put 10 different types of recipient up, there are different ways of acting for each of those recipients, and it helps change the mind. So I guess this sort of says that he presents the material so we can have many different ways of looking at it. And then the mind will actually change.
So Eddie, is that because when we actually get specific about things, it's more important? It's even like when we do our puja dedications, it's kind of easy to go yada yada yada, all sentient beings. But if you start actually thinking of individuals or groups of people, it's got more emotional impact.
Yeah, that's right. That's the example. That's sort of the example that Geshe La used. He used the example of like the giving and taking meditation. And if you just say all sentient beings, because that's what it all comes down to, it doesn't have anywhere near the impact if you started off like with yourself, with your mother, with your sister, with your brother, and made them individuals first, you know, and then into groups of three, and then went to the animals, then went to the different realms. And so, well, then your compassion would be very different, and your concern for them would be very different.
Yeah, well, it's all literally embodied then, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah, we have the mind has a big difference, isn't it? Then just say all, and then you put some people up, you know, and then one of them might be, yeah, we know all sentient beings. We can categorize them also as friends, enemies, and strangers. And, you know, the mind is different to friends, different to enemies, and different to strangers.
But even just saying, all cats and all dogs.
Yeah, that's right.
Just itemizing like that brings it much more, colors it in. Jeanette McCready has a question. She's not sure how she can give the gift of fearlessness to others. So it's just going back one slide.
Well, you know, like say for, do you have any pets at all, Jeanette? If you feed a pet or an animal, now that would be given the gift of fearlessness. If you shelter people, if you save an insect,
it's even if you practice social distancing, sanitize your hands, or wear a mask, you are offering protection right there. That's often right. At the cost of your own sense of
comfort,
liberty, and pride.
Oh, I didn't see it like that. Sorry.
So when you protect children from being afraid, Jeanette?
So it's Carolyn here. I also read somewhere about it also involves equanimity, that people who are, you know, racially different groups or ethnic or, you know, people with different sexuality or that it's not discriminating against them because they have a fear of discriminating. And so you give the gift of protection by yourself being an example of not of practicing equanimity towards others.
Yep, that's right. That'll be another.
Yeah, that's actually a very good one that we can easily do.
Okay, so the next question is, so when we when we have this motivation, it's always got this, it goes along with these three. We've got to focus on these three things. The purpose of the motivation is enlightenment. That the thing that's been given has only just been held in trust by us. It doesn't belong to us. It's not mine. And that when we give it to the person, the other person, we should always see them as a spiritual friend. That's nice, isn't it? Three purposes. Three focuses, sorry. The purpose for engaging in generosity is to achieve enlightenment for yourself and others. The thing, whatever you're giving, it actually doesn't belong to you. It's just held in trust. And whoever you're giving it to is a spiritual friend of yours. They are helping you attain the enlightenment that you seek.
Thank you.
how to feel about the gifts. Once again, these objects are entrusted to me. In fact, they're owned by others. I'm just holding on to them for when they need them. And the special support, those who you give to, you know, these people are truly my spiritual friends. Without sentient beings, we cannot become enlightened. So we definitely need, you know, the field of merit, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and their teachings of the Dharma. But if we don't have people to work with, we cannot get enlightened. So they're called like the special support for enlightenment. And one of the ways of having a great sort of respect for them is to acknowledge that through your dependence upon them, they bring you to enlightenment, just like the actual teacher that you call a guru. In fact, later on we go into Yoga Tantra, isn't it? It's all beings are your teachers. There's no difference at all between them and your other and your teacher that you often call guru. Now, there are types of, once again, ideas or types of motivation that have to be stopped, have to be eliminated. And these are six or seven of them, seven. So they've got these names, the supremacy of bad views, conceit, dependency, discouragement, turning your back, expecting return and expecting fruition. But what do these terms mean? Right. So the first, the supremacy of bad views is that no results come from giving. So this has to do with karma. So just, you think, I'm not going to give because nothing good comes of it. The second is conceit or arrogance. So that you look down on others and then you don't want to give them anything. The dependency is really looking at that it will bring me a good reputation. I'll be seen in a good light by others. Discouragement is referring to just being sort of having low spirits. You're just depressed or something and you just can't be bothered. Turning your back means being biased and having a sort of retaliatory attitude. It's a bit like what you said before on just a moment or two ago, Caroline, about being non-biased. Expecting a return that in some way we're going to benefit from generosity in this life. And last is fruition, which we are really concerned about having a good rebirth in the human realm with resources. So those types of motivation need to be eliminated.
So, Eddie, that one, the second last one of expecting a return, That's quite a tricky one because you may start off not expecting a return, but after a while, you're trying to practice well. And if you have a run of what we call bad luck, where, say, you get ripped off how many times in a row I give up, I'm not going to do this anymore. It's not worth it. Or, you have a flip over and then the expectation of return kind of reveals itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So we often have to make the mistakes before we can discover that our practice is not as good as we would like it to be, as all we thought it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because of that discouragement. It comes along, and I suppose the discouragement happens because we're just focusing on this life.
And not only that, we're also focusing on what we're giving rather than the mental attitude. Like I said, so we've already forgotten these things don't belong to us. We're just returning them. They're not ours anyway. So there's a lot that we forget, you know, when you say you're coming to expecting return. You know, so I'm trying to encourage everybody through this module to just take these, you know, there's a lot to remember, but there's a couple of things that you can really hold on to, I think. And one is, whatever you've got doesn't belong to you. And the other is that everyone else is my spiritual friend, and I'm returning to them what they just gave me to hold on to. So when we forget those two things, then the rest is going to happen.
Eddie?
Yeah?
It's Jeanette. That last one, expecting fruition.
Yep.
Isn't... We are hoping for a better life, aren't we?
Yeah. Let's go to the next slide, Jeanette. Let's go to the next slide, because there's a couple of questions asked about this, which I think will help answer the question. So okay. We'll go to the next slide. I'll ask the questions, and if you need a bit more added to it, you speak up, please.
Okay.
Okay. So the next one goes, eliminate the expectation of fruition, right, which is this last motivation. Right? So the questions are, should we not be motivated for future lives when we give? That's one question. And the second one is, how should we understand this last motivation we should eliminate, that of expecting fruition? So here's a couple of answers. Does that help, Jeanette?
Not yet, but not I'm yet? Waiting okay. for you to tell me.
Okay, so add your question too.
No, these when you explain these two, I will understand.
Okay. So first is, should we not be motivated for future lives when we give? So the answer is, bodhisattvas do not practice generosity intending that their actions are seeds that will ripen as prosperity in a future life. That attitude is to want a good life in samsara for oneself. A bodhisattva should see that every aspect of samsaric life has no real essence, is inferior and mixed with suffering. Bodhisattvas do not give gifts looking for samsaric wealth. Second part, how should we understand the last motivation? He says, do not misunderstand. When a bodhisattva or anyone else is generous, moral, patient, and so on, the result of these meritorious actions is to be born in an excellent high rebirth. However, a bodhisattva is not looking for those things. Now, this is not contradictory. It's not right for bodhisattvas to view those results as their goal. They should not be emotionally attached to them and strive to obtain only them. However, rebirth with an excellent body, wealth, and retinue is a suitable temporary goal. It is a vehicle or a means to reach the main goal, perfect Buddhahood. Ordinary bodhisattvas, those who have not had a direct realization of emptiness, must be reborn in samsara. In samsara, they need a perfect body and an appropriate environment in order to help them and others. So we should not reject those results. They are an important, although provisional, tool. A bodhisattva should simply avoid putting all of his or her effort into achieving a samsaric body and wealth as a final goal. So this term fruition always refers to, it's you know, fruition, karmic fruition. So that fruition always refers to rebirth within samsara. So the bodhisattvas, that's not their aim. The bodhisattva's aim is to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of sentient beings.
I thought in one of the classes we said that bodhisattvas do aspire to be reborn in samsara because they see the suffering of sentient beings and want to be there to help them.
Well, how would they be able to do that if they were samsaric beings?
I don't know.
Yeah, well, they're not very... That's why it's not... What they say is the bodhisattva aims for enlightenment for the benefit of others. But of course, you know, you have the same. It takes a long, long time to become enlightened. So until that enlightenment takes place and they're no longer under the control of karma and disturbing emotions and so forth, they will take rebirth within cyclic existence. Yeah, and where is the best place to be reborn in cyclic existence? In the human realm. In the desire realm as a human being with the leisure and opportunity to continue their path and help sentient beings. It's just what they're saying here is don't make that your goal because they're two different goals, Jeanette.
So, Edie, one of them might be to say that a bodhisattva aims to be not to be born within the context of samsara, like, but not of it, like in the world, but not of it.
Yeah, that's
another way. So, because the aim is still always enlightenment, but to be there for others. So the aim isn't samsara, being born into samsara.
So I was just thinking, as you're saying, this another example is the example of like climbing mountains. So you could make your goal to climb Mount Egmont. Mount Egmont's in New Zealand. You could, that's your goal. You're a mountaineer, and your goal is to climb mountains. Now, you can aim to climb Mount Egmont or to climb Mount Everest. Those who are trying to climb Mount Everest can't do it straight away. So they start off with Mount Egmont. You might do other mountains in Europe and so forth. But that's not your goal. The goal is to climb the highest mountain. These other goals come on your way. So until you've climbed the highest mountain, you climb the smaller mountains. But the goal is always to climb the highest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
That's okay.
Thank you.
That's a great example, that one.
Thanks, Eddie.
Okay, thank you. Now, the next question is, look, we've got these obstacles. So one of them is caused of stinginess. So when you're stingy, you hold on to what you've got. You know, you don't want to release it. So another term for that is just called hoarding, holding on, hoarding. And this is seen to be problematic. The question is, what are the difficulties that might arise through hoarding things? So, and here's the answer to this. First of all, there's no extra merit gained. There's this idea of like, you know, you turn away requests for help and to be protected and so forth. Your own stinginess, of course, increases all the time. But it's also troublesome, problematic to safeguard your possessions. So here from the Lamrim Chinmo, bodhisattvas see that it is wrong to give resources that they have stored up, where it is not wrong to give them away as you acquire them. This is because there's no additional merit in storing them up and then giving them at one time, and because you turn away many requests for your goods while you are storing them up, then you could also come to feel tormented and may give them to someone who has not asked for them. So these points stated in the bodhisattva levels are very important, for you can see that during the period of storing up the goods you can produce many afflictions such as stinginess and the like, that the trouble of safeguarding them and so forth becomes a hindrance to many virtuous actions, and that often you lose them at some point and are not able to give them away in the end anyway.
Eddie, I don't agree with that one about stinginess increases. From my own personal point of view, if I've saved some money and I keep it in the house, so I'm saving up some money in the house, and if some of my kids want some money for something, they really need it, then I've got that money to give them and I do give it to them. So I don't understand how that stinginess increases. Not in everybody, it doesn't in me.
No. So I'll give you an example. So, you know, these more billionaires. So the question was asked to the billionaires, you have so much money, why do you need more? And if you need more, how much more? And I think they needed $20 million more dollars before they felt content.
Yeah, well, maybe that's them, but that's not me.
No, that's right. So
I don't feel that.
But if you watch those programs on those who hoard, man, they have big problems, and it's very, very hard for them to let go of what they have. And not only that, they keep going out to different places to get more of those things.
But in you don't have a hoarding motivation, Jeanette. You have a kind of a giving motivation. I think hoarding is problematic where the motivation, the intention is to keep it yourself.
Yeah.
But that's not your motivation of why you're doing that sort of, I wouldn't call that hoarding. I'd probably call it, keeping resources for when they're needed.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Thank
you. That sounds right.
Yeah.
I think so, Eddie, part of this too is like if we, often if we're saving up to go overseas or, to pay off the mortgage or whatever, and people request for help, there is a way that we go, oh, no, I don't have the money, because we've earmarked it for something else.
Yeah. There was this film I remember with Gary Oldman in it at the beginning. And he was a policeman who had become a corrupt policeman. And I always remember the thing that he said. It was called Romeo and Juliet. But he said, I fell in love with a hole in the ground. And that really struck me because I saw that film after I'd become a bit corrupt myself, And that's, I thought, I'd done the exact same thing. I used to go to this hole, dig it up and count my money and put it, hide it away. And then how much have I got? I need more. I'd use that money, get some more, put it in the hole in the ground. Then one day I decided, I'll get a stereo. So I had to take the money out of the hole in the ground, go and put a stereo. Bought the CDs, and I thought, shit, now I've got less money. I need more money. Go out and do the business again. And then I was always worried about, what if someone finds my hole? So they call this the sufferings of wealth. So
that sort of applies to superannuation as well.
Yeah, I was just thinking. Superannuation is our hole in the ground.
Yeah, but I don't have that problem. I'm quite happy. I'm quite happy to spend Willie's superannuation. I don't understand people that need money upon money upon money upon money. I just don't understand that.
Well, you can see things like, for instance, so you've got to be careful and not take it all as like it is this way. Because I think later on, might not be here, but there is this one where you can be asked for your robes if you're an ordained person. Actually, this happened to Lama Zofa at one time, He saw somebody with very little clothing on, went to take his robes off to give to them. And that's sort of like a no-no. So you have to hold on to things. And they often said, you need two sets of robes. So you can say, well, that's not hoarding. Anyway, there's seven ways to give, and these are them. So, of course, there's all much commentary on this material too. So let's look at the first one without delay. So not giving right away, but only after you have delayed. So it's not right to make someone wait a long time if we could give something to him or her right now. So we should give as soon as we can. If there is a spiritual purpose for waiting, well, it's okay to postpone your generosity. But it's wrong to delay giving needlessly. So seven ways to try and give easily. So giving under duress, not to make someone suffer or do difficult tasks before we give them something. You know, oftentimes we say, oh, if you do this and that, I'll give you this. I'll give you what you want. But the thing is difficult for them to do.
Eddie, I'm just thinking, looking at these seven ways to give and the multi-billionaire, the lady who's just given away $4 billion with her divorce settlement money. So she's given, you know, without delay and given easily, you know.
Yeah, research that's right. She probably meet all of these, isn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it really points out how the accumulation mentality to become wealthy doesn't easily translate into giving it away, because it is such an exception. You know, there's like, you know, the Gates and her, and that's about it that we hear about.
Mm. Yeah, there's probably many more, but at the same time, we don't hear of them, do we? We often hear more about accumulating stuff. But they're the ones we sort of go, oh, wonderful. But still, so there's, of course, much more commentary on this, and we've spoken of it before. Question is, what are some ways we can encourage giving in others? That's the question. What are some of the ways we can encourage giving in others? We can help our teachers, students, or friends or so forth who are willing to give but have no wealth, with the intention of helping those people, you know, so that we can give them those things and then they can give them away. So you often see, when we give things to our teachers, you might find later on somebody else has got it. Our teacher's given it to them. Mm-hmm. So you can help your teacher practice the perfection of generosity by giving them gifts, and then they give them away.
And so even a really small thing we can do with that is when we write a card to our teacher, to write the letter on paper and put it inside the card, because then they can recycle the card and give it to somebody else.
Yep. We can ask others to lead ourselves and others, and then rejoice in the merit. Telling stories. Right? So, you know, like we've been doing tonight, today, we've told a few stories. Tell other stories in which even the poor or the miserly wish to give. And alternatively, we can send those who are reduced, who are in poverty, to places where they can be assisted. So therefore, we encourage others to give them wealth. Now, our time is just about up, so I'm going to have to sort of rush through some of these things. So here we have the first question is, what's the main division that Lama Tsongkhapa makes in dividing things into what is to be given and is what is not to be given? So it's internal things and external things. They're the two divisions. Inner things are the body, either the parts of it or the complete body. Whereas the external things refers to the belongings of the person. Now, there are also appropriate times and inappropriate times to give those inner things. So, you know, the body is like this, the inner thing. The appropriate times are, like you say, appropriate time, and the conditions are meaning when you have the correct attitude. So we have the this correct attitude, and we're going to bring about the great purpose, which is the perfection of whatever the perfection is, and enlightenment. And the person who's asking has to be sincere about it. This is give your body away for a great purpose. And oftentimes I always say, like, you cannot give it away if the time is not right. So the time is really in relationship to the different paths. So if we don't actually have great compassion, we should not give the body away. If we do not have the realization of emptiness, it's another time we should not want to give the complete body away. But yeah, like you and I, we have some compassion. We could decide to give parts of our body away to help others. We can do that now or in the near future. But always, you know, realize the purpose. Why are you doing it? So when there's these five parts in the way of giving out of things. So it's inappropriate giving from the viewpoint of time, the gift, the person, material things, and it's again the purpose. So this is answering a question. What are the five parts involved in this section called inappropriate giving? What are those sections?
Eddie, just before you go on, there is a question from Robin about in terms of the correct time or the great purpose, giving your body away. Yep. So those monks who self-immolate, who set themselves on fire and give their bodies away in that way, is that like a suicide or is that a great purpose?
Well, what do you think? Why was it done? Robin, do you know? Do you know why the monk set himself on fire?
Well, I don't know the individual monks, but generally, like the motivation, I imagine, is for you know, the good of many, and like by doing this, it's not like they're just consumed with depression, as far as I know. It's more like they think that by doing this, it might bring about some change, I believe.
Yeah, well, the one in Vietnam, for instance, the one that grabbed the world's attention, that was done to, like, stop the war, to bring to the attention of the world what was going on in Vietnam and bring about a change.
So you could actually see that as almost like a perfection of generosity rather than just, you know, on the worldly level of a suicide, for example.
Yeah, well, the worldly level would be suicide, right? Because the worldly level is just concerned with this life.
Yeah.
Right? So you could actually see this as being an act of great compassion. And you could also know that he's obviously, I'm just going to go back there now. Whoops. So his purpose, of course, is to bring about an end to this war. The attitude you can still see, you know, when he sat there, like, that guy's definitely on some path. He's attained some level of the path, hasn't he? Because an ordinary, you just sit anybody down and set them on fire and watch what happens. But they run around screaming. It's like incredibly painful and all the rest, right? But that didn't happen to that person. So you could say the time was right for him. He had the necessary spiritual attainments. The purpose was one to bring awareness to the world of what was going on in Vietnam, to try and put an end to the suffering that was going on there. Now, I don't know whether anyone asked him to do this, but it was a sincere gesture. Anyway, we come to these five here. And so what they want to do is just, you know, briefly say a couple of things about the inappropriate, briefly explain inappropriate giving from the viewpoint of time. And here they use the example of food. So it's not appropriate to offer a monk food after midday. Right, so that would be an inappropriate giving from the viewpoint of time. From the viewpoint of the gift, sometimes it says, you know, the gift, like for instance, I say you can't just put money in the hands of the ordained. So that's one instance, but there are quite a number of different instances. For instance, like giving away people, giving away Buddhist scriptures to non-Buddhist people who have commercial interests and so forth. So there's a number of different gifts that are inappropriate to give. and appropriate giving from the point of view of the person. So the person, of course, is referring to us, the one who is actually giving. And material things, I really talked about here in the text. They use the example of the giving of the monk's robes, for instance. So it's not appropriate to give away certain material things. Like, for instance, in this case, being an ordained person and giving away their robes. With purpose. So it says, we should not fulfill the request of someone who asks for poisons, weapons, fires, or intoxicants for the purpose of harming others. But so we know that we are well within our rights to say no. So there are instances, lots of them in the text actually, when it's inappropriate to give due to some temporary circumstance, where it's something you want to avoid and not giving. However, if the circumstances change, then it might be, you know, you can give again. So in brief, these are like the 40 questions we've gone through and their answers for the exam. So I've asked Biffy to put up this, you know, the first 40 questions up there, and also the last 16 questions that we'll ask, we'll answer in our first class next year. So that will cover all the 56 questions. And I wanted to do it this way, one, because we just didn't have time to do 56 questions in one day. And the other is that, so over the time of this, over our break, you won't forget completely this material. And so that when we do our first class next year, it'll just be, once again, like reviewing those last 16 questions, which you will all have access to, and I hope you'll have a try at answering some of them, just as a way to try and keep the material fresh. Because, you know, because like, well, while we're going through a period of giving now, we've got our Christmas period, then there'll be the New Year period, and we find we're always giving, or things have been given to us. So, like I said, just a way to sort of not forget it all, have it all just slip away. Oh, sorry. So, like all this material, well, the answers to all the questions are within this material here that we've got up under reading. There's a heap of it, of course. But like I say, we've only got 16 questions left, so it's in the very last section of the reading. It's not all of it. So if you do have access to it, please have a look, see what you can recall. And even better, if you could put some of it into practice. So we've come to the end. Is there anything else anybody else would like to ask? Or
Kate's asking how long the break is. So, Kate, we will reopen always after Australia Day. And
this first one will be on the 7th of February.
There you go. Eddie's on the ball. I'm impressed.
So 7th of February. So we've got a good bit of time, haven't we? And like this material will be up there for you to have a look at anyway to refresh your mind with.
And we've got Christmas as our kind of generosity bodhisattva boot camp.
That's right. Okay, so we've come to the end then. I just want to thank you, all of you, for being in these classes, helping me, and I'm helping everyone else too, because I know, you know, all of you are trying to put it into practice. That's the main thing. So
thank you, Eddie.
Let's put it into practice, knowing that's all empty of inherent existence. Therefore, it actually dependently exists. And it can bring about results, good results. Let's aim for those results and thereby repay the kindness of our teachers, kindness of the Buddha himself, and of all sentient beings. Let's bring about our own welfare by becoming enlightened and helping everyone else do the same. Okay, that'll do.
Thank you, Eddie. Thank you, Eddie.
Thanks, Carol.
Thanks, everyone. All the best, bye-bye. Everyone.
See you, Jeanette.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.